This is Bristol, and you are listening to a podcast from the BristolCon Fringe reading series. Hello everyone, and welcome to another BristolCon Fringe reading. We're delighted to see so many people back, and indeed delighted to have seen the reception that we've got to our first recording. Those of you who haven't seen, the podcasts of last month's event are now available through our website, and I was surprised and delighted to get an email the other day from the podcast hosting people telling us that we almost reached our bandwidth limit on downloads for the month, and that we have to go over to a paid account because so many people have been downloading it. And I went and checked the stats, and we've had over 550 downloads of the readings from last month, so clearly lots of people around the world are actually tuning in to see what's happening in Bristol, which is great. It's wonderful. Anyway, today we have two other excellent writers who are going to read their work for us. And as usual, we have the other stuff available. We've got some books here. Tim Maughan has kindly brought along copies of his book Paintwork, which I heartily recommend. Sold quite a lot of those through the Wizards Tower bookstore. And also, we have another book that he has a story in. It's Adventure Rocket Ship, Volume 1. Let's all go to the science fiction disco. And again, Wizards Tower did the ebook edition of that, and we've sold quite a lot of those as well. And it's got loads of fabulous non-fiction in it as well, that one, all about the intersection between science fiction and music. As usual, we'll be taking breaks between the readings so that you can order food and beer. And now I should probably stop wittering on and actually introduce our first reader for the night. Now, I've been practicing pronunciation of his name, and I will probably still manage to mangle it, but our first reader is from Poland. He's Peter Schrytlik. That'll do. Yeah. That's a reasonable approximation. You know, I find it hard enough to write fiction in English. The idea of writing fiction in what's essentially a second language is really just incredibly daunting to me, and I think it's amazing that people like Peter managed to do this. But he does write great fiction in English, and I'm sure he writes great fiction in Polish as well. He has a story coming up in the forthcoming Wizards Tower anthology, Airship Shape and Bristol Fashion. I'm not entirely sure what he's going to read to us tonight, but yeah, we'll invite him up here and see what he's got. Ladies and gentlemen, Peter.
Okay, that's weird. I'm going to read you a story which is not quite finished. Well, it is finished. Still needs a couple of editing notes, probably. And it needs a title, which is the last part that I'm struggling with. But anyway, it's got a motto instead of a title. Que medicamenta non sanat, ferum sanat. Que ferum non sanat, ignis sanat. Which in the loose translation is, what the medicine cannot cure, the iron will cure. What the iron cannot cure, the fire will cure. In the beginning there was pain. His back was on fire. He fell to his knees and the world around him lost sharpness. He heard some faint voices, whispers, shouts, too distant to make sense of them. Pain ruins his concentration. The skin along his spine started to pulse, slowly at first, rhythmically. In accordance to that rhythm, the world seemed to now the eyes pulsed with all the colors of the rainbow. The rhythm and the pain increased, reducing all other stimuli to those pulsing colors. Sounds, colors, smell, all merged together until the cells could not withstand the pressure and wings erupted from Nathan's back. White, semi-transparent pains weighed gently. The pain has stopped and Nathan got up without effort. Wings beat stronger, lifting him up into the air. Everything became incredibly clear. The delicate shimmering contours were gone. Nathan's body shook with joyful laughter coming from the depths of his being. He looked at Eric. His friend, his companion in so many ventures, stood a few meters aside with surprise painted all over his face. His lips moved soundlessly. Nathan looked up deep into Eric's eyes. He was aware of all his thoughts, the conscious ones, as well as those that lurked, swirling on the edges of his ego. Power flew through Nathan, making the back of his head tingle. And as Eric's lips started to form into a smile full of understanding, a wave of energy washed over Nathan's mind. Spectral wings appeared more solid for a moment, glittering with the full spectrum of light. Eric grunted and grimaced with a surprise as he fell to the stony floor, dead. He broke free from the dream and sat on his bed, combing his small hand through his hair that was damp with sweat. Jared entered the bedroom. "Everything all right?" he asked. Nathan nodded his head. "Would you like some breakfast?" "Yes, thank you. I'll eat on the terrace." "Of course." Putting his feet on the cold floor, Nathan sat on the edge of the bed, remembering the dream. He hadn't had it for a while. It must have been a good 10 years since the last time. He thought about that for a moment. Exactly 10 years and 3 months since the expedition for the Jumper. The expedition that made his name known throughout the inhabited world. He got up, went to the bathroom, and took a long shower. He felt better right away, dressed, and went down to the terrace. Breakfast was waiting. Scrambled eggs, a few strips of bacon, fresh ego sauce, and a big pot of coffee. Nathan attacked the food and went on to enjoying the morning caffeine. The view from the terrace was impressive. The subtropical jungle of Silence 3 was one of the most beautiful, if not the most beautiful, collection of flora in the known universe, and Nathan owned its most astonishing region. The lush green carpet of leaves swayed gently in the breeze and was dotted here and there with bright flashes of colour from the huge insects that flitted about. The view calmed both the senses and the psyche. At least it usually did. This day, the forest seemed oddly alien to Nathan. All its familiarity was gone as it melted away by warm morning sun. The first explosion burst from the jungle a few dozen kilometres to the north. Nathan jumped from his armchair and ran to get the binoculars. Before he could return to Earth, the Earth shook twice more. The next explosion was much closer, only a few kilometers away. The forest was on fire. Thousands of insects flew up in panic, a vibrating cloud that mingled with the smoke over the treetops. Nathan placed the binoculars back on the table. He had no enemies on Cygnus, at least no one, none powerful enough to try a full frontal assault on Nathan's mansion. And none were rich enough to hire an expert to override his detection system, which failed utterly. He called for Jared. "Wake the guardians and prepare a jumper. We're leaving." Jared nodded his shaved head in reply and hurried inside the house. Nathan went back to the bedroom and started packing. A few minutes later, he was ready, as was Jared. They both entered the jumper and went up into the air. Another 3 minutes later, they were in orbit, awaiting departure. Nathan switched the vision on to see a vast area of the jungle set aflame. It seemed like a deliberate act of vandalism. For a split second, he spotted his villa hiding in a hillside and turning into a fortress. And then they jumped. Yesterday morning, one of the most terrible acts of eco-terrorism in history took place, involving the famous forest of the insects on planet Cygnus 3. Considered to be one of the most beautiful natural wonders known to man and a tropical rarity, the forest has been burned to the ground. So far, nothing is known of the perpetrators. Part of the forest belonged to Nathan Connell, the famous... Nathan switched the receiver off. "Do you have any suspects?" asked Walter, Nathan's friend and right hand, folding his hands over his fat belly. "No," Nathan said comfortably in a soft armchair on the opposite side of the desk, the size of an airfield. "I have absolutely no clue who might hate me so much." "Well, I know a few who would give a lot to see you in a coffin," Walter pointed out. "True, but there are few. But they lack either the money or the freedom to act, or the courage for that matter. Perhaps one of them gathered enough of it necessary to act." Walter blew out his lips. Nathan shook his head. "No, it was a professional job." Walter scratched his chin and stared at the glass of rum standing on the desk. "What about the house?" "I haven't checked yet, but it should be fine." "I'd like to ask you a favor." "Of course, anything." "I want to find out who did this and why, but to do that I need to leave for a while. I'd like you to take care of the business when I'm gone and give Jared something to do. He'll be furious if you offer him hospitality for nothing." Walter nodded his head. "Will you go alone?" "Yes, this is a personal, and I need to solve this for myself." "What about?" Walter asked quietly, raising his eyebrows. "I have it with me. Who knows, it might be useful." "Well, let's hope not." "Let's hope. I need to go. I still have some things to sort out." "All right, go. I'll take care of everything. See ya." Yesterday, at 1530, a bomb exploded in the GTG building. An explosive charge was detonated on the 46th floor where Nathan Connell's agency offices are located. 7 people died, 23 were injured, including the agency director Michael Dolan. No, terrorist group has claimed responsibility for the attack. The only clue left for the Venetian police was a handwritten note saying, "Not only is Moria," placed on the background image of a phoenix. According to the chief of police, the investigation is proceeding. Article fragment from Venetian Daily, dated 18th July 2764. The picture shimmered and flicked for a moment. "It is done," the huge man sitting in the leather armchair said bluntly. "Perfect, mon ami. I knew you could handle it well." The picture flicked again, stretching the view of a man's face, which was half prosthetic. "All I need now..." "No," said the giant. "I've told you already, I won't do it." "Her friendship is that important to you?" "More than you can imagine. What about the money?" "The payments have been deposited to the account you've selected. It was nice working with you." "You do realize he will find you and kill you?" A shadow of a smile sneaked across the disfigured face. "I'm counting on it. Adieu." The picture died out. The sky outside the bungalow windows got darker. From somewhere beyond the mountains came a roaring thunder. A storm was coming. The man sitting in the leather armchair switched off a panel built into his left forearm, scratched his beard, and stared at the fire roaring at the grate. The gleam of reflected flames danced merrily on the plates of his implants. He sighed heavily and scratched his beard again. He was anticipating trouble. The jumper went into Venus orbit at exactly 8:30, right on schedule. Nathan switched the vision on and without sympathy looked at the green planet. Green not because of the layer of toxic clouds that covered it in the distant past. Those were more or less terraformed long ago. Venus was green because of most of its surface was covered by forests of one kind or another. A relatively small population resided mainly in a few cities scattered around both poles. He didn't like Venusians. They were impulsive and got emotional too easily, which was a combination that irritated Nathan intensely. Nevertheless, he had an agency here, an agency that someone decided to refurbish yesterday using large quantities of explosives. A degree of suspicion had started to grow in him yesterday. He had some inkling as to the answer to the question who, but he wanted to be certain. Besides, there was also the obvious question of why. Anticipating a long busy day, he wrapped his hand around a small item in his right-hand pocket of the black trousers. He focused, and for a little while, gently, drew. Memories. "One more time, please." Nathan looked at Fiona. She was smiling. A storm of blonde curly hair surrounded her head, falling to her naked shoulders and round breasts. She sprawled on a soft lehenda mat, supporting herself on one elbow. He sighed, unable to say no. "Very well, but this is the last time, for real." A playful spark appeared in Fiona's blue eyes. Nathan sighed again, pretending defeat, and set the figures out on the board. The pawns stood in straight lines and saluted. They began to play. Chess was one of the main entertainments during what they called a decadent week, apart from sex, of course. The decadent week was a tradition of their relationship. Once every 3 or 4 months, they cancelled all meetings and for 7 days indulged in all that was pleasurable. "Check and mate," cried Fiona triumphantly, ending the game in 42 moves. Nathan shook his head in resignation and smiled. She leaned over him and gave him a hot kiss. Nathan touched her breast. They both laughed, quietly, briefly. The air was saturated with the sweet smell of Lily of the Valley. For a long while, the house echoed with rustles and movements. And then, the defeated king fell with a loud sigh, in two voices. Drew. Now he was ready. He programmed the jumper for stationary orbit and ordered himself a shuttle. It thundered, flashed, and started to rain. Ghastly wind flexed the branches. The trees brought to mind silhouettes of Dance Macabre swaying madly. Now and again, blinding flashes of a violent storm lit the dark, clouded sky. Heavy drops whipped the thick tropical forest into a frenzied staccato on the wooden roof of the bungalow. Nathan took a big gulp of whiskey. "Same price as always?" he asked. Of course, Bernard stretched his 200-pound body in the armchair, making it creak. The light from the fire flashed off his implants. Where do you want me to deliver it? Nowhere, I came in the jumper, explained Nathan. He caught the twinkle in Bernard's eyes, so to dispel any doubts, he added, it stayed in the orbit. Bernard smiled with understanding. He didn't count on seeing the inside of the jumper again. It was Nathan's office, transport, mobile home, and who knows what else that has become legendary in the last decade. Bernard was one of the very few people to have seen it up close and travelled in it. One of those few was the equally legendary Fiona Hunt. Both Fiona and the jumper accumulated hundreds of rumours around them. He knew them all, and knew that all were imaginary. They did not even touch on the truth. Would you like another drink? No, thanks, I'm in a bit of a hurry. Nathan stood up and put the hand cut crystal tumbler on a small yellow table. The table lifted itself on its carved legs and slowly walked back to the kitchen. Nathan shook his head. I don't think I'll ever get used to it. Ah, I like it that way, Bernard smiled, showing teeth covered with hundreds of tiny conservation robots. Where did you leave your shuttle? About 30 kilometers away in a valley. So if you could lend me some transport. Nonsense. You'll take my Hermes. I'll have it ready for you in a few minutes. That's quick. Nathan followed Bernard into a corridor that led down and up and left, finally opening to a wide hall. He didn't remember it from his last visit, but he was not surprised by that. The layout of the rooms in Bernard's house changed each year. New stone past Olympus. We do have comments, you know. Most of the gear was already waiting for you. Nathan smiled. Thanks. That's all right. Kiss Fiona for me, will you? I sure will. Nathan crossed to the ship, which opened its door invitingly as he approached. He sat in a comfortable soft chair. The door started to shut soundlessly behind him. Good luck. Nathan nodded in reply and took off. Bernard stood in the empty hall for a minute, looking after the disappearing ship that was now only a bright dot against the dark background. A few memories rushed through his partly organic head and they stretched his lips in a smile. He closed the hall and went back to the bungalow. The storm was giving way, but rain would still slash the surface of Helet as if trying to drown the whole planet. It focused its rage on the mountain Olympus and a wooden bungalow near the summit. Bernard placed more logs in the fireplace and filled a hand-cut crystal glass with a large dash of whiskey. He drank it down, poured, and drank again. And then, using a panel implanted in his left forearm, he connected to a waiting call from very far away. The house was empty. A faint smell of lily of the valley filled the air, bringing to mind spring and love. Everything was silent, that specific kind of silence suggesting that someone will suddenly appear from around the corner, or the air will fill with a merry whistling from the bathroom. Regardless, no one replied to his insistent shouts. Clothes were strewn about in chaos, smashed on thick vases and half-open closets suggested one of two things. Either someone was in a great hurry to leave, or a fight had taken place. Nathan was pretty sure the first option could be excluded. Fiona had no reason to leave her residence in such a hurry, damaging her precious collection. And even if there was a need for it, it was not her style. On the other hand, fighting to the end was very much in her character. Nathan knew that a pointless, hysterical rush would not help him find her. He forced himself to slowly, meticulously check all the rooms of the Mist House. That's what they'd named the villa when Fiona moved in. When they were together, in older days, happier days. He thoroughly inspected the walls, furniture, the pattern of the scattered sculpture pieces. He was searching for a sign, a clue, a message. He was certain the attack on his mansion, the Venus bombing, and Fiona's disappearance were the work of the same person. He was nearly convinced he knew who was behind it. What he needed was an unwavering certainty, and somehow he knew he was going to find it today. A xylograph caught his attention. It depicted a hill crowned with a wind-rustled poplar. Something about the picture was different, but he could not really see what. He sighed and took his right fist wrapped around a small object from his pocket. He focused and drew pictures. An explosion tossed a huge steel door into the air. Right behind it flew Bernard, a big sack, and Nathan, in that order. Bernard fell, somersaulted and leapt up, sweeping the surrounding area with a heat ray. He helped Nathan to his feet and lifted the sack containing the recovered treasures. He tossed it nonchalantly over his left shoulder, smiling as he did so. "Quick, before they figure it out," said Nathan. Bernard nodded his head and vigorously walked to the transport, which was hidden in the shadow of the building opposite. The first bullet hit him in the middle of the chest, causing him to stagger. Another two pierced his stomach and the head. Nathan reached his friend in two bounding leaps. He found the shooter and took care of him with one bullet. The sounds of a chase came from the building behind him. The air resonated with the sound of police sirens. Backup was coming, but for Bernard it was already too late. "Nathan," he whispered, "shut it. Help, it's on its way." "Eric is," he wheezed before he died. Nathan grabbed his friend's body by his legs and dragged him to the vehicle, running back for the sack. A series of bullets from the guns rattled against an armored hull of Bernard's transporter. Nathan shrank down into the seat and started the engine. Closing the door, he noticed a picture lying on the floor. He looked at it more closely and suddenly it was obvious. And Drew, synchronizing with the picture instantly. Now he knew. Weaved in the thread of the woods was a burning sign. The past does not return as a living phenomenon, but it dies not. Nathan took his eyes and attention from the silograph and energetically walked out of the front door of the Mist House. 213 seconds later, jumper's engines were ready and the wide ribbon of the road unfurled before them. Through the lands of the shadows, among electromagnetic whirls, inside deserted gravity wells, the wide ribbon of the road leads on and on and beyond. Dispersing dust and dirt, the jumper moves through the universe. Behind it and before it, time and space shrink and unfold like a yellow scarf. The stars remain still. Dotted here and there are the particle atoms that flash, charting the track. Somewhere to the left, an unknown nebula preens with red and violet. To the right flashes a border post. When the path ends, Nathan takes the controls and leads the ship far beyond what is known, into the void and darkness. The road unfolds itself forward and forward, and throwing tons of sand soaring into the air, the jumper landed and dug itself deep into the dune. It cleared its way down until finally coming to a full stop. At 60 meters below the surface, the sand was dark and wet. Nathan flung a backpack over his shoulder, checked if his pockets were sealed, picked up a large bag and stood on the plate of the escalator. And then he flew through 16 meters of gravel, dirt and sand. When the escalator's cocoon folded and sank back into the floor, a strong wind ruffled his black hair and rammed its sandy fingers in his face, stinging his eyes. Nathan snorted, disregarding the grains that whipped his skin, and started ahead. Half an hour later, he reached his destination. Half buried in the sand stood the Yellowstone building. It looked exactly as he remembered. The only parts of its low, white structures sticking above the sand were two wings and a downward pointing ramp, with the darkness of an entrance at the end of it. Nathan shivered involuntarily. It had never occurred to him that the building resembled a wide open muzzle, with wings like greedy arms, and the ramp an expectant tongue. He looked around but could see nothing beyond a few small shrubs. He sighed, shrugged his shoulders and slid down the slope. Finally, Eric's voice was distorted by a steel prosthesis that supported his left eye, cheek and a part of his jaw. His right hand and part of his hip were also replaced with metal parts. The rest of his body was enshrouded in a dark cloak. The crooked chair he was sitting on was made of scraps of horn and pieces of wood. All around lay weird, twisted objects. Nathan had an inkling of what they were. She was lying in the left-hand corner, curled and unnaturally still, with fair hair scattered across her face and spilling over to the colorful floor. He felt the rage burning inside him. He waited for two heartbeats, reached for it, and released it in one quick action. He didn't make it. Watching Nathan with a mocking smile, Eric squeezed the white stick he was holding. It was an almost casual action, but in an instant, the whole of Nathan's gear transformed into hot cinders. Nathan ripped off his clothes as they started to smoke. "Oh, Nathan Connery, didn't think it would be that easy to kill me again, did you?" This race, he raised his hand to encompass the whole giant complex, created many powerful machines. "And since you left me here, I had plenty of time to earn.
You died, snapped Nathan, ignoring the pain from the scattering of burns. You're absolutely right, replied Eric calmly.
And hence we both know the past. There's no point in prolonging this farce.
No, said Nathan, there isn't. He opened his right fist and looked briefly at the metallic shining object that sat on his palm. He shouldn't have done that. As he raised his eyes, he felt a blow against his chest. He flew back, slamming into a wall a good 6 meters behind. On his chest, blooming from the shattered remains of his ribcage, shone the red rose that was his life. He realized he had lost, that he had died. With a last effort, he shook his head, focused and tuned up to the artifact. Stretched his tentacles and buried them into the hand that was holding him. Checked the spectrum, uncoiled the neural pathways and drew visions.
I never would have suspected, Jared shook his head. Right in front of him stood something that resembled a terpus corpus of a man trapped in a grasp of a steel octopus, tentacles gleaming with all the colors of the visible spectrum.
Neither would I, said Nathan, until I saw the picture and other things.
Anything in particular?
Not really. Some invoices for private schools, a couple of game tickets. I don't think he was keeping up a very close relation with him.
Are you certain?
Considering that I didn't even know he had a son?
No, I'm not certain of anything anymore.
After a while, Nathan added, I feel sorry for him, for both of them.
Still no luck? Jared peered once more at the sculpture that was no sculpture at all.
No, the artifact does not want to give up to him. Nor will it respond to me. There's something in his psyche.
And drew. He felt a stab of pain and the spectral wings burst from his back. White, translucent pains waved, lifting him up. He felt the warm stream of blood stop. His tiredness drifted away and his senses sharpened. He could see more clearly now, inhaled the strong stench of blood and sweat, heard, yes, he could hear three hearts pounding. His joy flared like a supernova, but he managed to calm down. There were things that needed doing first.
No, said Eric calmly, extending the arm holding the white stick towards the unconscious woman, or she dies.
Nathan had no choice. He did not want to expand his collection of nightmares with one that, in which he allowed Fiona to die. He stretched his right hand out, fist tightly clenched. No, he couldn't. Didn't want to separate. He saw so much, experienced so many new things. This symbiosis offered so many possibilities. He didn't want to lie for a thousand of years, forgotten again. He was patient, but he didn't want to be an ordinary man again. The wings gained substance for a moment, shining in the dimness of the hall with all the colors of the spectrum. Memories came flooding in. He was back in one of the lower rooms of the complex. The half-light, the stone stairs with strange things piled on top of them, the dust and silence made it feel more like a temple. In the center of the room, they found a pedestal and on it the artifact. It lay there, shining, gleaming in the light of the headlamps. Nathan couldn't stop himself from picking it up. The pain he felt then stayed with him constantly, buried deep in the memory and mixed with the feeling of his back being torn apart, his spine shattering into pieces. And then there was the amazement, euphoria, power, and Eric's death. He should have never taken that damn thing. He shook his head, he focused, and completed separation. He stood on the stony floor again. The artifact was curled in the palm of his hand, reflecting light of his metal carapace. Nathan looked at it for a last time and then threw it toward the chair. Eric caught it in the air. The artifact stretched its tentacles. Memories, pictures, visions. Daddy, Daddy, I'm here, here. Laughter and the right up to the face of a huge man with steel teeth and arms reflecting sharp sunlight from the patches of his implants. His gaze is blue, serious, and deep like the lake at night. I love you, says woman, lying next to him. Her naked arm is soft and warm. The hand gently strokes his torso. Her hair smells of apricots, and behind her ear, she has tucked a mallow flower. Phew, I didn't think it would be that easy. Nathan's face is sharp against the
against the bright background of the desert sand. The discovery made fact, the joy of learning way down, ancient dust raised by the feet, protected by metal and plastic. The main storage with hundreds of machines on small pedestals.
and in the center it, excitement, bewilderment, fear, understanding, and right after that pain, 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 and darkness. Pictures, visions, memory, and sunk them into Eric's hand, and drew, drew, drew. Eric froze in its stride, entwined with a net of tentacles that shone with vibrant colors. In between the tentacles, bright sparks flashed, lighting up Eric's body. The net already covered the steel prosthetic hand, grasped the deformed cheek, and rippling slightly, kept going. The sparks shone even brighter as the net enclosed the whole of Eric's body. It left only his eyes, which were full of pain. Pain and fear and wonder. What happened to Eric? I don't know. Perhaps he was unstable. Does it mean that you've lost, that you've become a regular... I don't know, he replied. I think so. Does it matter to you? No, said Fiona, smiling. Absolutely not. Well, let's go back then. He took her into his arms and carried her towards the doctor. Fiona rested her head against the white scar that disfigured his chest. The wind ruffled their hair, wiping their bodies with its sandy fingers. Nathan paid no attention to it. Despite the wounds, he walked straight and vigorously, placing his feet 3 inches above the desert sands. Thank you.
BristolCon Fringe is a monthly reading series produced by the BristolCon Foundation. Our thanks to the Shakespeare Tavern for providing us with a venue. The music at the beginning of this podcast is The Future by Chevy 174.